Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone.
Help. All right, it's time for another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. Glad you're with us tonight. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio and at his home studio facing the lake. A man whose golf game only lacks power, control, and accuracy, George P. Fraser. Hello, George.
I thought you were going to introduce me from now on as the winner of the punt, pass, and kick.
Well,
like
no,
they do that's the Hall of Famer, Troy Aikman. I thought we were...
Well, we need to discuss that. I think that's a good idea to always introduce you that way. Yeah. That is your claim to fame.
Well, it's the only one I have, and gosh, it's always good to do the show, and I know we have a good guest coming up tonight, Bill.
Yes, we do.
I never get tired of seeing what God does in people's lives. Never get tired
nope.
of it.
Nope. Stories of transformation, dead in your sin to alive in Christ. I can listen to these stories all day long.
You know, it was interesting this week, and I don't know if you saw any of it, but Captain Kirk went up into outer space.
I did see that.
And he came back, and he was really emotional, and I heard him talking. It was like he had like a religious experience, a spiritual experience. We get to see that all the time, that you go from, instead of going from light to black, as he was talking about, mm-hmm. we go from black to light. And I never get tired of having God reaffirm to us that he's there and he's active and he always has been and he always will be. And that's why I love doing this show.
Yeah. And William Shatner, also known as Captain Kirk, said something else from his trip to space, which I found interesting. He was all overwhelmed with emotion, practically had tears in his eyes. And he said, I hope I never recover from this, which I thought was interesting because I hope that I... never recover either from having my life changed by Jesus. I want to stay in that state of eternal gratefulness, eternal joy, and eternal anticipation of the hope to come.
Amen.
Amen
well
to that.
Said.
Thanks, George. I say good things once in a while.
I think, you know, occasionally we hit a home run and you did. I would think for him, though, he's 90, he won't have to remember it too long, but, you know, we'll move on here. I kind of wanted to tie this in with the steps we're going to talk about. And we do two steps at a time twice, 6 and 7 and 8 and 9. And 8 is we're entirely ready to make amends. We made a list of all people we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them. And then 9, we made direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And the reason I wanted to talk about this, Bill, is that a lot of times when we get out of trouble and we find God and we get restored and we get sober and everything's wonderful, we're thinking about ourselves instead of the wreckage that we might have done.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, guys we work with, the consequences for what they did catch up to them after they get sober and they're working their new life. They might have to go to prison. They might have to pay a debt to society. They might have to pay back a lot of money. And I wanted to talk about that. And the reason we write these down, we make a list, is to be thorough. And there's something magical about writing it down, Bill. It seems to really stay in our head. And then we make these amends to people. Do you owe somebody money? Don't tell them you're sorry. Pay them back. We've both been on the wrong end of that one, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
We don't want to go down. We don't want to go down that road. But if you're truly going to move forward, you got to take care of your past, and you can't have any doubt in your mind. You know, I should fix that. I should pay Bill the money I owe him. But you know, I'll get around to it. I think, Bill, from my own experience and working with other people, the way to really, truly move forward is to not have any time bombs from the past that are going to explode on us.
Mm-hmm.
What say you?
Well, I agree, George. And I think of the difficulty that you go through. And I think our guest's story tonight is going to chronicle a lot of this difficulty and suffering, but I think what we're going to learn tonight is that through this suffering, God had something pretty spectacular intended. And I think that's something to keep in mind when we are feeling like our back is against the wall. Maybe we feel sorry for ourselves. Maybe we feel like there's no hope for me. I've really messed up this time. There's nothing that can be done in this situation. And that is 100% a lie, because God can work all things together for good to those who love him and who are called according to his purpose.
The great Romans 8:28. And I think sometimes to really wrap our arms around it, if we can, Bill, mm-hmm. we have to think eternally, in that a kid dies from cancer. Okay, it's real hard to see God in that. But what if one of his parents wasn't a believer?
Mm-hmm.
And they become a believer because of that happening and their need for God. The examples of that are, we've got to trust God. But when we talk about people getting sober, I haven't met one person yet who really told me, yeah, I'm looking forward to getting sober.
Right.
We see that God did for us what we couldn't do for ourselves, but let's be honest, we didn't even want to do it.
And part of our sanctification process is by working the steps. We don't work the steps for any other reason that they point us to Christ, mm-hmm. that how badly I need a Savior.
What does humility look like in a good recovery plan?
Humility in a good recovery plan. Well, how would I know? A good recovery program.
Yeah. Yeah. You have a great recovery plan.
I think it's because I realize how messed up and needy I am. You know, I talk a lot about I don't know
That's
anybody.
That's humility then, right?
He needs a Savior more than I do. Yeah, I think the proper relationship, Bill, and when we first met, you asked me, why don't you ever speak on holiness? And I think that was right. And I said, I don't know. For me, the humility is that I really don't know, because if I look at my addiction years, I was doing what I wanted to do, and it was killing me. Therefore, I really don't know what I want. One of your guests the other week on your program in the afternoon, Dr. Glenn Pickering, a good friend of Real Recoveries, said the biggest problem is people don't know what they want.
Mm-hmm.
So really, the question should be for us, what does God want from me
mm-hmm.
and for me? And so that's what we're looking at. And I think keeping the humility is realizing I'm not God. There is a God. It's not me. And I'm here to serve him rather than have God serve me. And I think for a lot of us, we talked about that. I want to have this relationship with Jesus so I get the car, the job, keep my family. You know, what do I get out of it? And it's a little prosperity gospel. You had talked about my illness before. I think for both of us, when we were going through the diagnostic procedure, because you were driving me, you were such a great friend.
I was paying for all that gas, too.
Yeah, well, you had the Prius.
It doesn't matter.
Remember I had that brown bag over my head so nobody would see me riding in your car? But do you remember that we kind of thought I'd be okay because mm-hmm. I'm a Christian and we're good guys? And
yeah.
I wouldn't verbalize that, but there's kind of that. Isn't there a prosperity gospel?
Absolutely. You feel like you've got this little hedge of protection around you, and that may not be the case.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we're going to hear a great story tonight. Our guest is named Mindy, and she's in studio, and she's chomping at the bit to get started. So, George, let's take our very short break, and then we'll bring on Mindy. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. We've got Ryan on the board tonight, as always, keeping the ship afloat. We'll be right back in just a minute. Welcome back to Real Recovery, Bill and George. Once again, we've got a great show lined up tonight. Georgie boy, we're going to have an incredible story coming from Mindy. She's going to be joining us in just about 30 seconds. I'm looking forward to it, and I know you are too.
Oh, gosh, always. Never get tired of hearing what God does in people's lives, Bill.
I couldn't agree more. So, Mindy, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Thank you for having me.
We're very glad you're here. And we're very interested in getting to know Mindy, and we want to start about hearing about your upbringing. What was your family life like? Was there some dysfunction there? Was there a church? Was there friends, family? What was going on?
Okay. Well, you could say there's plenty of dysfunction in my family. I grew up with just my mom. I had an older brother who went to live with his father around third, fourth grade. So it was just me and my mom, and she struggled with addiction most of my life. I had some good family members in my life. There was never a faith component in our family. We went to church, I think, with my grandma like a few times. Maybe got baptized, but nothing. Nobody was following Jesus in my family. So I had made a commitment at a very young age because of the dysfunction with my mom that I would never do drugs. I would never grow up to be like her. And around 13 years old, my mom moved, and I had good friends. I grew up in Sault Ste. Paul with the same group of friends. I always went to the same school. That was, even though we moved around a lot, my mom made sure I stayed in the same school. And I found a lot of value in my friends. They all had, like, good families, so I'd spend a lot of time with them. And then around the age of 13, my mom decided that we were going to move to Cumberland, Wisconsin. And for me, that was a huge culture shock. And then I was being ripped away from the family support that I did have down here with, like, my grandma and my aunts. I would no longer have that, and then I no longer had these friends. So I was upset. I was very upset and very resentful. What my mom didn't tell me was that she was moving to Wisconsin so that she could start her life over and get sober. I took it as, like, a personal attack, I guess you could say. So I find myself as a teenager living in this tiny town of, like, 1,000 people, and I'm mad, and I'm, like, acting out, I'm vandalizing things, I'm doing everything I can to make my mom's life miserable because I feel like she had done this to me. So I would say it was about the age of 13 I started drinking. It wasn't, like, heavy drinking by any means. It was just if it was available. I had so much pain I wanted to, like, numb and forget about. And then about the age of 14, I started experimenting with marijuana and LSD, mushrooms, all kinds of psychedelics. I'd found a new group of friends, and they were all into the same things as well. So that was kind of what we did up there in Wisconsin. And eventually, it started just leading to more and more harder drugs. And although my mom was sober, I would not say that our life had gotten any better. There was still so much dysfunction and, like, anger, and, yeah, we just weren't, it just wasn't the, like, family unit that you would hope for, the support that you were looking for from a parent. So I just immersed myself in drugs and alcohol and partying, and, yeah, it just kind of escalated from there.
So does your mom, when she moves to Cumberland, Wisconsin to try to get sober, does she not notice that her daughter is probably using?
I believe she did use. My mom is a person who would say, or she would, like, rule with fear. Do as I say, not as I do. Mm-hmm. And so she didn't know. And I was very, very out of control. I was on, like, being brought home by the police. I was vandalizing things, starting things on fire. So I don't think she had the capacity, like, in her new sobriety to, like, control what was going on with me. I found myself in foster homes. She had a series of boyfriends that I was not a big fan of. So I eventually just, I'd run away. Sometimes I'd come home. When I did, it was volatile. And then I'd run away again. And I did all that until I was about 17, 18. I finally dropped out of school. I left home, like, for good. And then I found myself back down here in the Twin Cities.
All right, so you are now 18, living in the Twin Cities.
Mm-hmm.
And how are you living? Where are you living? Are you working? Are you paying your bills? What do you have going at this point?
I had reconnected with a childhood friend, and I was living with her. We were not. I think I was working for a short period of time, but I thought it was, like, a new start. And I came down here and just got into the same things, and I would say even, like, more so because there was more things available. So I was living down here, 18. I eventually found myself homeless. I reconnected with my dad, and he had, I had siblings. I had four sisters. So that felt like maybe the family unit that I'd been looking for. There was a lot of dysfunction there, too. My dad struggled with addiction, so we started using together. Me and a couple of my sisters used together. So it just, I feel like I was always looking for something, you know, knowing and like growing up with friends who had like normal families. I wanted for that. I just knew that I didn't have it. So I was always looking for that. And when I met my dad, and my sisters, I thought that's what I was getting in it. Something very different.
So there's hurt and disappointment there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
So amidst the dysfunction, you think you're stepping into something that's going to help normalize you, but there's just only more dysfunction.
Right.
Yeah, George, I think we've heard a story so much like Mindy's where you're looking for a place to belong and a place to feel loved and cared for, and you keep looking in all the wrong places.
Yeah, and when we go to Cumberland, we wind up hanging out with the kids who use. That's always the easy way out. You got new friends, you got new activities. We all want to belong, and you can hear the longing here, Bill. It's sad.
Mm-hmm. So I know you've got a question for Mindy, because I can just tell you do.
Well, were there parts you're using you liked?
Oh, yeah, definitely. When I was very young, you know, it started off as a party thing. It started off as fun, you know, a way to connect with other people. But over time, what I realized it was a way to numb my pain, to not have to partake in what was my life.
So, go ahead, George.
Did you have any thoughts? Yeah, sorry, Billy. Did you have any thoughts? What did you want to be in the future, or were you just day-to-day surviving?
Let's see. At a young age, I had dreams and aspirations. I would say they were probably very unrealistic, you know. I want to be a marine biologist. I want to be that. I want to be this. And when you look at the opportunities that were available to me, I don't know that any of those things were going to happen without a lot of hard work. And I wasn't really that interested in that. I was more interested in partying and connecting with people. So, yeah. And to be honest with you, after about the age of 19, I started to realize that my life was revolved around drugs. And I accepted that. Well, my mom and my dad both struggled with addiction. Even though my mom had gotten sober, it just seemed like, well, this is my life. I didn't really plan on living past the age of 30.
So, you know, you're 18, you're in the Twin Cities, you're using, you've connected with dad and some sisters, but you're still using, are you still in contact with mom?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So things obviously are going to get worse from there.
Oh, yeah. Yep. So eventually my mom ended up relapsing, and then she went and spent some time in prison. So she wasn't gone for a long time. But for me, I was like, man, you were sober for so long, you know, but she didn't go to meetings. She didn't do any of that. She still had all these like things that, knowing now what I know, she needed to heal mm-hmm. and she needed coping skills and all that. But she just stopped. So it wasn't a big surprise when she went back, but it was definitely a disruption in, like, my life. Shortly after that, my father was diagnosed with leukemia. And although our relationship had been strained and whatnot, he was still, you know, a parent to me and my father. And so I was having a hard time with that. And I think after that, things really started to unravel for me. I was like, man, I was like, I'm going to die this way. Like, this is really my life. And I had gotten married at a really young age to a great guy. He is, my best friend to this day. But he struggled with addiction as well. So we were married and just codependent and dysfunctional and selling drugs. And my dad passed away, and I think I kind of lost it a little bit then. I ended up leaving my husband and just kind of went, like, full bore. Like, I was on the streets selling drugs, large amounts of methamphetamines, running around with guns, you know, in different states all over the country. And we'd been doing this for, I don't know, the first 5 years of our marriage. So it's not that, you know, it was that uncommon. I was just taking a lot more risks with it. Eventually, I was randomly pulled over. There was a firearm and a large amount of methamphetamines in my vehicle. There was a high-speed chase, and then I was finally captured, brought to jail, and then later on indicted by the feds. So I was looking at 15 to 20 years in federal prison for a large amount of meth and a firearm.
George, I don't know if you know this, because I need to ask the question to Mindy, but if you are selling meth and you talk about being in various cities selling meth with a gun, how do you know who to sell to? And how do you know you're not selling to someone undercover?
Oh, well, that's, you know, I didn't deal with a lot of people. I think when you deal with larger amounts of meth, you're kind
it's
of fooled.
Some trusted people that you know.
Yeah. Well, I don't think you can ever really trust anybody fully in that, but they're people that I'd known for a long time. Yeah. So
what happens too, Billy, is that you might have trusted customers, but if they get pinched,
yeah,
they're going to turn. And that's how a lot of people get caught. But it was interesting that you used the word they captured you. There was a chase. Did you get addicted to the lifestyle too?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah. I say capture because we fled in a vehicle and then I fled on foot. So it felt like a capture at the time.
Sounds like it was too a capture.
Yeah, it was.
I was watching NCIS or something here for a minute. And so what was that like looking at that much time?
You know, to be honest with you, at that point in time, my life had spiraled so out of control. I knew that it was going to be death or jail. That's just something you accept when you live that lifestyle. I could go to prison for a really long time. I could die. Those are just kind of, you know, I never really believed that I would get sober. So it wasn't a surprise. But what was difficult for me is that I hadn't really come down off of meth in like 10 years. And so I was facing all this time. And I'm finally, like, detoxing from meth. My mental health is, like, a mess, and I'm suicidal. So it's really difficult to commit suicide while you're in a jail cell. I'll tell you that much. Thank God. But looking back now, I realize that I remember. So I've never been a person of faith. I always wanted to believe in something like Buddha or the Tao or the star, you know, just something magical and mystical was controlling my life or something like that would just like one day maybe rip me out of it. But I remember the day before I got arrested, I remember thinking to myself and like crying out, and I didn't cry out to Buddha. I didn't cry out to the stars. I cried out to God. And that was so strange for me because I wasn't a believer, but I knew that there's something that could do for me what I couldn't do for myself. And when I got pulled over, I didn't realize that it was God, you know, because I fought that. I was like, oh, no, they ain't going to get me. But later on, I realized, like, he did for me what I couldn't do. I wasn't going to turn myself in. I wasn't going to go to treatment. I wasn't magically going to stop. So I had to be stopped.
Mm. All right, we'll take a little break. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. Our special guest, Mindy, is with us tonight. We've got a lot more story to go. We'll be right back after just a very short break. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill and George, our special guest Mindy tonight. It's got quite a story. George, I'm not surprised when there's difficulty growing up and you start to experiment with friends and you start to party that you start to actually like the party lifestyle. And that's going to cause problems as well, isn't it?
Well, it works for a while. And it can be very fun and exciting. And then maybe you get in and you go, whoa, I got too much excitement going like 15 years in a federal prison.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where we left off, wasn't it?
It is. So, Mindy, you ended up being on a little car chase, foot chase, and the police have now apprehended you. You're in jail and you've cried out to God for something. You're not sure what it is yet.
Right.
But you are now in jail and you find out that you have an opportunity to go to Teen Challenge, Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge.
Right. So the opportunity to go to Teen Challenge wasn't really available to me. I applied, they accepted me, and but the feds wouldn't let me out of jail. They said I was a flight risk, a danger to society, and all types of other things that I couldn't wrap my head around. But
you're talking about George now or yourself?
Yeah. George.
Are we birds of a feather? You were talking about Georgia for a minute.
Oh, yeah. I'm a danger in sobriety.
You're a flight risk. You're going to go to Arizona for a couple of months and play golf. That's a flight risk to me.
Yep.
Trip to golfers. Yeah. What was it like to hear that you were a threat to society?
You know, it's funny when you're selling drugs, you have like a code like, oh, I won't sell to pregnant people. I don't sell to children. I'm not doing this, not doing that. And all these things that you tell yourself that make you feel better about the situation. So to hear that I was a danger to society, it didn't register to me. I was like, what are they talking about? Well, what they're talking about is the fact that there's a pistol in my vehicle. I got into a high-speed chase, and I'm, you know, peddling poison everywhere I go. So at the time, I still felt like, you know, that label didn't fit. But looking back, it definitely did.
So you have this opportunity to go to Teen Challenge. And what were your thoughts about going into a recovery, faith-based recovery program? Was it something that was a deep desire of yours, or were you just trying to look good in front of the courts?
Oh, yeah, no. As a drug addict, I think everybody knows about Teen Challenge, and the first time I went to jail, a lady came in and spoke about it, and I knew that if my life ever got so bad, if I had a court case or anything like that, I'd go to Teen Challenge because it would look good in court. And so my intentions weren't to find God, to find sobriety. It was methodical and planned out, and yeah. And so when I did finally like get there, I was very well behaved. I knew that I was supposed to be in jail, so I was going to do the program. I was going to fake it till I make it is what I used to say.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And do tell us about that experience.
Oh, gosh.
Because you did fake it for a while, didn't you?
Yeah. The first 6 months of my program were, you know, that's exactly what it was. I was faking it, and I was just... My only thing was I wanted it to look good in court. After 6 months of being in an intense faith environment like Teen Challenge, you start to see God working. And at first, I didn't see him working in my life. I saw him working in other people's lives. And I was like, oh, man. I was like, that couldn't have happened. Like, that's
supernatural.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so I just started, like, making, like, small prayers. They're like, okay, Lord, if you could do this or do that. And God doesn't like to be bargained with by any means, but I think he knew that I needed something for my faith to increase or for it to even develop. So it was something as simple as, I forget what I asked for. It was like pineapple for lunch or just something silly mm-hmm. and trivial like that. And we had never had pineapple for lunch. And there it was. I was like, I'm a believer. That's what it took. Like the Lord knew. And then after that, he just continued to work in my life, and I started to see things change. I think probably the most significant thing that happened to me at Teen Challenge was experiencing God's love through other people, like love that has no agenda, that has, you know, just like pure love from strangers. I'd been like seeking out love from the people that I knew in my life, you know, my entire existence, and then to find it in complete strangers was amazing to me.
So you've got these friends, these family, you always hoped you would feel love from them, and then you didn't.
Yeah.
So you've got this emptiness, and then you get around people who love the Lord,
yeah,
who are speaking into your life and loving you where you're at, and you're starting to feel what that love is like.
Yep.
And it's transformational, isn't it?
Oh, 100%. I mean, my self-worth, my value, my purpose, I found all of that through Teen Challenge.
And that doesn't happen overnight. I mean, that's,
oh God, no.
That's the thing you have to be constantly reminded of. As much as you'd like to have some of your problems solved, God doesn't work that way.
Nope. I was in a place where everybody speaks about like restoration, and I was like, well, I don't know that my life was ever in a place that I want it restored to. You know, and the more I learned about the Bible and the more I learned about God is like restoration isn't about setting you back to a time when it was good. It was about restoring what God had originally intended for your life. And I had no idea or concept of what that was. But as I went through the program and I got closer to graduation, I knew that he wanted me to work with people.
Yeah. So tell us about your meeting Jesus and coming to faith.
Well, to be honest with you, I was a little upset at first because everybody's like, well, I just heard God speak to me. And I'm like, well, I don't hear an audible voice. Mm-hmm. I hear my own voice like speaking back to me. And so I was waiting for this like aha moment or like this radio announcer voice to come in and be like, Mindy, go to the left and not to the right, you know? And what I know about myself is I'm a visual person. I'm a creative, visual, kind of a little weirdo a person. I like art and like strange things. And so I was in worship one day and he gave me a picture in my head. I was like, well, I'm a pretty creative person, but I definitely didn't dream that up. And so that's when he would start speaking to me in pictures. And sometimes I didn't know what they meant, but other times, like, he'd back it up. I'd be reading my Bible, and it would all come together and make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Some of the things you were seeing in your head, you saw sort of verified in the Word of God.
Yep, and then through other people as well. So I was like, okay, all right, I get how you're trying to speak to me now.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So can you give me an example of one of these images and then how it connected into God's Word?
So I had mentioned in, let's see.
So I find this fascinating.
Yeah, so I had mentioned that I'd left my husband, and I was like such a codependent person that I was like praying like, Lord, if you could just fix that relationship. And I was in worship one day and he had showed me a picture of the cross, like kind of erupting from the ground, like, and getting higher and higher up in the air. And then two people kind of like floating around it, like rising up to the top. And then a third, like little person, like came like floating up as well. And like I said, I was like praying that the Lord would restore the relationship. And it didn't seem like that was going to happen. My husband was pretty upset with me. But eventually, as I drew closer to God, I kind of drug him along because he'd come and visit me and at the churches and stuff like that and bring me Skittles when I wasn't supposed to have Skittles and, you know, all that stuff. So he would come to church and, like, I would just, like, I'd talk to the pastor. I'd be like, hey, that guy over there really needs somebody to speak into his life. And so he came to faith as well. And then our marriage was restored and our relationship was restored. And then later on down the road, we had a child. But I'll get to that part.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll get to that part a little bit later. I skipped a huge chunk.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a chunk missing.
Yeah, there is for sure.
Yeah.
I'm going to jump forward and tell you about graduation. So I graduate from Teen Challenge. I'm still facing quite a bit of time in federal prison. I had finally accepted a plea agreement for 8 to 10 years. They dropped the gun charge. They said, we don't think that was yours. So that like dropped my charges down quite a bit. And I was like, well, that's probably the best deal I'm going to get. So I accepted 8 to 10 years for the methamphetamines and intent to distribute. So when I went to court, I had been writing letters to my judge and kind of telling him what was happening to me at Teen Challenge. And like I said, in the beginning, it was really intentional. I wanted it to look good. About halfway through Teen Challenge, I started sharing the letters probably looked a lot different, talking about God and like what he's doing and not just what I'm doing, but what God has been doing. So when I went to court, my judge, he like took one look at me and he goes, I have no idea what happened to you in that program. He goes, but you are not the same person that I saw in here a year ago. He went below the standards and he gave me time served for Teen Challenge. He gave me 5-year sentence, which he's like, I don't even know if I can do this, but I'm recommending this. And then he recommended I do another treatment program in prison. So after everything was said and done, I had sat a year in county jail. I did a year in Teen Challenge, and then I did less than 2 years in federal prison. And that was really the start of, I think, me understanding the calling that God had on my life. I knew that he wanted me to help people. I knew that I didn't go through everything, you know, just to go out and be free and live a life. You know, I knew that he called me to missions. I knew that he wanted me to help save the lost and to share my story and, yeah, to support other people and show them that love that I experienced when I first got to Teen Challenge.
Hey, George, what's one of the many things you say every week? Say it again.
God doesn't save us from our addiction and our sins without having a job for us, and we get to work for him. And it doesn't get any better than that. Did I say the right thing, Bill?
You said exactly the right thing. Okay. And Mindy's shaking her head yes. So I think
absolutely.
I think that confirms exactly.
Yeah.
So
Mindy, you know, when you talked about seeing the love that other people had for you, I think part of the magic looking back for all of us is when we realize we're almost as happy for them when they graduate as when we do, that something's happened there. You do remember that when you started loving other people too?
Yeah. Yes. And I think my staff probably remembered when that happened too, because I wasn't very pleasant the first part of my program. I was not nice to people. I kept my hood up. I followed the rules, but I kept my hood up over my head. I didn't want to engage with people. And then all of a sudden it just switched. So.
And that's when you got saved, and that's when you started to understand what was happening to you.
Yeah. Yep. 100%.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what happened. All of a sudden, like the new people that came into the program, I was like, oh, hey, welcome. Let me tell you about Jesus. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then just going forward a little bit, like when I got to prison, because I had to go serve my sentence after I had served time in Teen Challenge, or after I graduated Teen Challenge, I had to go serve time. And I was probably the happiest inmate ever because the Lord had told me, you're going to go in there and you're going to serve me. And I was like, woohoo. I was like, this is my first missions trip. I was so excited to go. You know, and also, you know, I was going for 2 years, not 20. So,
yeah.
So the excitement, you know, that might have something to do with it. But I knew that if people could just understand Jesus and accept him, like that their life would be different. And I was going into a place filled with broken people.
What was it like for you being in federal prison for a couple of years, knowing that God has a job for you to do while you're there?
Yeah.
And there is so much brokenness. So tell me what that time was like.
So I kind of went in guns a-blazing. Well, not guns a-blazing anymore, but like ready to just, you know, like preach the gospel and all this stuff. And I realized that, like, I ran to the church. I was like, I need a job in the church. And they're like, well, this is a cush job. So, like, there's no jobs available. We don't know when one will be, because it was an easy job. Some of the other jobs are a little more strenuous. And I was like, well, all right, Lord. I'm like, if I'm not going to work in the church, then what do you have for me? And I got a job working outside the gate. I had low criminal points, so I got to work outside in the garage and the facility on like perimeter vehicles and stuff like that. And then later on, I was given a job as the town driver. And that was an opportunity for me. I tried to use everything as an opportunity to, you know, serve the Lord and serve his people. But I would take inmates from the prison and they put them on a Greyhound bus when they were done with their sentence. And because in federal prison, everybody's from like a different area in the country. And so they'd send you back on a Greyhound bus to your halfway house. And so I always knew when I had a trip, I didn't know who I was going to be driving, but the Lord would like give me a verse for them. And one thing that I realized there is that people are far more scared leaving prison than they are going into prison. And so never once out of all the trips I made to the bus station, did anybody ever say, no, you can't pray for me. And so that was like, okay. I was like, so you're always like, I have to look for the ways, right? No matter where you put me, I'm going to serve you. So if I'm a job in a garage driving people around, I'm going to find a way to serve you. And I think that developed in me like just like ministry doesn't always look the way that you think, right? I thought it was going to be this. I would be preaching sermons to people or leading groups or this or that or the other in the church. And he's like, nope. He's like, let's see, be faithful in this and faithful in that. And I just always found a way to serve him.
Did you ever get the cushy job at the church?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Nope.
Yeah, but God used you in big ways.
Yeah, he did.
It's so interesting, Mindy, that you say that they're more afraid to leave prison than they are to come in.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you are stuck in that cycle, in that life, it's easy. You go into jails and prisons, like, in facilities all the time. It's easy. You don't have to do anything there. You literally go there, and you don't have to look at yourself. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to make any changes if you don't want to. But if you don't, then you're probably going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. But leaving, you know, if you've lived a life of crime and, you know, you're leaving and it's like, okay, now I have to do well. How are you going to do that?
A lot of pressure.
Yeah, a lot of pressure.
All right, we'll take a little break. When we come back, lots more with Mindy, Real Recovery, Bill George, Ryan on the board. So glad you're with us tonight. We'll be right back. Back with our guest, Mindy. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. If you have missed any of this, you're going to want to go to myfaithradio.com. Check it out. The podcast is available after the show and will continue to be available. Mindy, so you've got this testimony now working in a pretty nice job at the prison where you have access to the outside.
Yeah.
They trust you enough that you're in a vehicle driving someone to the bus station.
Yeah, isn't that insane?
That's insane.
Yeah.
Because you're in a federal facility.
Yep. And I had only been there for a short period of time when I was approached.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you wanted the cushy church job, but God's given you a job which gives you literally more freedom.
Yep.
More access to pivotal relationships, like the people that you are connecting with as you're driving to the bus station.
Yeah.
And you're their last voice of encouragement before they go off. And you're praying with them. And so you've got ministry in your blood, don't you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I love that.
Yep.
So now you work at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge.
Yes. Yes, I do.
Tell us about that.
I've been working at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge for about 9 years now. After I got out of prison, I ran back to Teen Challenge. I was like, yo, give me a job. They're like, slow down. You know, let's see what you're going to do. You just got out. So after a year of, you know, just being out, getting a job, serving the Lord, rebuilding a life, I started working there. And I was able to pour back into the people who were just like me. So that was deeply rewarding. I have a daughter now. She's 6 years old. She'll be seven soon. She's a feisty little thing. And, I've been working there for 9 years. I am now in the position of a recovery chaplain, aftercare chaplain. So I served as a recovery coach for 5 years. For 4 years, I was a program manager, which is the person who doles out the restorative assignments when somebody gets in trouble and stuff like that. So it didn't feel like ministry, but I was really good at it. But the Lord said it's time to do something different. So now I'm in a role where I get to support our alumni, which is really cool, and build community for them and provide resources for meetings and aftercare housing and stuff like that. So I feel like I'm doing what I would do naturally in life.
Mm-hmm.
And I get paid for it, which is incredible. Another really cool thing that is dear to me that I love doing is I serve as a mentor for high-risk women coming out of the federal prison. I do that through a program called the Reentry Program with the feds. So I do that, and then I teach a class in the very prison where I was housed.
Wow.
Yeah. So anybody who is within 6 months of the door at the Waseca Federal Prison, we offer a class called Project Connect. And so it's just about aftercare planning, how to succeed after prison. And, yeah, it is just another miracle that I'm allowed to walk back into that prison in, like, normal clothes.
Yeah. What does Mindy today think of Mindy from, I don't know, 20 years ago?
Oh, man. I think that somebody once said to me, they're like, from my old life, they said, you know, you're the last person that we thought was going to get sober. And
wow.
That sits with me because people from my past reach out, and when they're ready to get sober, they call me, they find me on Facebook, or I run into them at Teen Challenge. But that statement, you're the last person I thought would get sober, is just funny to me because it makes me think, then probably anybody can do it, huh? Like, you know, if I'm the last person, then just anybody else can do it. So Mindy today thinks that broken, lost Mindy from, you know, years before is just... it's just a journey that I was allowed to go on so that I could be who I am today. Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
And there's curious as to your daily disciplines in terms of your spiritual walk and all of that.
Yeah. So it's funny. I just had this conversation in my book study yesterday. How do we, because in Teen Challenge, you get the structured, you get like faith built into your day for you.
Sure.
You have morning devos, you go to chapel, you do all this. And then when you get back into the world, it's really easy to lose sight of those things. And, but Jesus has to be a part of my day every day, like the main part. He has to be, you know, the first, the middle, the last. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm walking in faith, I'm walking in prayer every single day. And that's what I need to do. I mean, it's really easy to get distracted by the world.
Mm-hmm. So, George, I would love I'd love for you guys to have a talk about relapse prevention, because I always think it's such an important topic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what I was going to ask, first of all, Mindy, are you working your recovery and your walk as hard 9+ years later as you were when you started?
Oh, that's a good question. I feel like the Lord, like, released me from, like, there are people who have, like, had to struggle with, you know, like, relapse and, you know, the compulsion to use and stuff like that. And I feel completely delivered from it. But the main thing is that I don't forget. I can't forget, because I've watched people who've been in recovery for, you know, 10 years fall back. And that's terrifying to me. So the Lord set me free, but it's my job every single day to make sure that I stay that way.
How do you maintain that? How are you working your recovery?
Mostly it's just my relationship with the Lord. That is key for me. I attend meetings. Because I'm the aftercare chaplain, I'm in meetings all the time and support groups and stuff like that. And I'm surrounded by a recovery community. I have core people in my life that will hold me accountable, that will process with me, that will call me on my stuff, you know, because drift and fade and stuff like that is a real thing. So I have people close in my life that will let me know.
Yeah, I don't like people in my life telling me when I'm fading away, but they're necessary.
Yes.
You know, the feedback, right? The good feedback is never good enough, and the bad negative feedback is way too harsh. But left on my own, I don't make it too well, right?
Right, right.
I'm glad. You know, I think when we're working with other people, that's what God had planned for us. But we also have to work our own stuff too, right?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
It sounds like you're doing that, and you had said earlier that God was doing for you what you couldn't do for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think He does stuff for us that we don't even want to do for ourselves? I mean, wanted to get sober, right?
Right, right. I don't think I could have done it without the Lord. I wouldn't have been able to do it on my own. You know, the police intervened. And at the time, that seemed like a tragic thing, but like Romans 8:28, He's going to work all things for the good, right? I suffered through everything I went through, and my wounds are now my badges of honor. So, yeah, I have no regrets. I spent 15 years in addiction and spent time in prison and in and out of jails and in some really traumatic situations, and I can honestly say I have no regrets.
Quite a testimony.
Yeah.
Bill, it's great, and I think we go through what we have to go through to get where we are.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no shortcuts. And the real miracle for me on 8:28 of Romans is when we think eternally, all the people you're going to meet in heaven that we're going to meet, that we've interacted with for eternity.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Mindy. It's been great having you on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You bet. That wraps up another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. On behalf of Bill and George, we're so glad you joined us. Have a great week, everyone. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.